The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha talked a lot about how and why we struggle, we suffer. He talked a lot about kind of the internal underpinnings of suffering, this maybe what we could call the psychology of suffering, how it functions, how it works. So he talked a lot about that, how we can look inside our own minds and explore and understand what's happening and why we're what is contributing internally to the reasons why we're suffering. But he also spoke about suffering in the world. He spoke about some of the underpinnings for that, of how and why there are wars and dissent and strife in the world. He used one particular teaching story to kind of elucidate some of the mechanisms at work. It'll be familiar to many of you, I think, this teaching story. It's the story of the elephant and the blind people. And so the story goes that a king asked for an elephant to be brought to the kingdom and for blind people in the kingdom to be brought and shown the elephant. And so the elephant trainer brought the elephant and gathered the people who were blind in the kingdom and then showed each of the blind people the elephant. To some, he showed them the legs and said, "This is the elephant." To some, the tail and said, "This is the elephant." To some, the side of the elephant and said, "This is the elephant." So all different parts of the elephant, that each person was shown a different part of the elephant and told, "This is an elephant." And of course, they came up with different perspectives on the elephant. Those who were shown the legs ended up saying, when asked, "What is an elephant like?" they said, "An elephant is like a post." Those who were shown the side of the elephant, when asked, said, "The elephant is like the wall of a storeroom." When shown the tail, those who were shown the tail said, "An elephant is like a broom." And so each person had a different perspective on the elephant. And then in hearing each of the other people's perspectives, they actually started fighting and came to blows, saying, "An elephant's like this, you're wrong. An elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that." And so the part of the teaching component of this story is that when we perceive something, recognize something in the world, we create a concept about it. So in this case, those shown the leg created the idea, it's like a post. And then what we tend to do is to take that concept to be some kind of reality. We take it, we form a view, we create a view around it and think, this is the thing. This concept is the thing. And so he points to how clinging to views, in this teaching story, clinging to views creates this social strife, social conflict. Does this sound familiar? Clinging to views, creating social conflict. And so he pointed to this as a very powerful aspect of our social difficulties, is clinging to views. Now, it's very normal to create views and to have concepts about what we know and connect with in our lives. It's very normal. This is, in fact, is part of a way we function as human beings, to have views and concepts. And yet what happens is that we take those concepts and those views, we take the concepts to be something they're not, we take them to be a truth, and we create and construct views around that. So in the example of the story of the elephant, taking the concept of an elephant is like a post, and then the view, this is an elephant. That is what an elephant is. I know it from my own experience. This is another piece of this story that I think is so powerful, because each of the people had a direct experience of the elephant. An incontrovertible, direct experience. They felt it for themselves. This is what an elephant is like. But what they weren't open to, and what views tend to do, is to collapse our perspective on reality and to not let other points of view come in. And so an elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that. Another piece of this teaching story that I have not heard talked about before, but just kind of came to me as I was reflecting on the story this morning, was the way in which we affect each other around the creation of views. Because in this story, the person who was showing the people the elephant said, "I'm going to show you an elephant. This is an elephant." And then showed them just one part of the elephant. They didn't say, "I'm going to show you part of an elephant." If they had done that, if the elephant trainer had done that instead for the blind people, said, "I'm going to show you part of an elephant," I can imagine the conversation would have been very different when they each heard the different perspectives. It would have been, "Oh, wow, let's talk about this. Maybe we can put together what an elephant is," because we each only got a piece of it. And so this is another way that we influence each other around views, is that when we hold a view strongly, we communicate it as truth, as fact, rather than as view. And so these are some ways that views can kind of lead to this conflict and this strife and this struggle. We use views a lot, partly because it's so natural, and yet what we are less aware of is that they are views. So many views come into our experience, and they come from our own direct experiences in the story of the elephant and the blind people, that we have direct experience of something and then a view gets created about it. But a lot of our views come in through our family, through our culture, through what other people think, through what other people believe, through what other people tell us. And these views then shape our experience, shape the way we meet the world, which in turn actually shapes the world. It may be hard to believe that our views can shape the world, but this is what we're looking at. This is what we are seeing in our world right now. There's an experiment that was done, I heard about a couple of years ago on a podcast called Invisibilia. And the study was taking, I think it was, you know, some first year graduate students in psychology, and they were being trained how to use mice to run them in a maze. And their task was to have these mice run these mazes. And when they went into the laboratory to do this, there were different cages with the mice in it. Some of the cages said, "These mice are intelligent mice." And some of the cages said, "These mice are stupid mice." I don't know the exact wording they used, but to that effect. And something like that on the cages. And there was no difference in the mice. This was the actual experiment, was seeing what happened if the graduate students believed. And why wouldn't they? I mean, why would they have any reason to not believe what was there? And so this is a way views can form. One exposure to a little bit of information from a source you trust, and a view is created right there. And so they believed these mice were different levels of intelligence. And then they trained them to run the mazes. They were, one of the things that they were counting or tracking was how fast the rats could run the mazes. And what do you think? Which rats ran the maze faster?
The smart ones.
The ones in the cages who were marked smart. They ran the mazes faster. There's no difference between these mice. It was simply the belief by the students running the experiment that had that effect. They did take some videos, and what they think was happening was the way that the mice were treated, that they were more careful and more gentle with the intelligent mice and less careful and less sensitive with the stupid mice. This is how our beliefs can affect, our actions can affect the world. This simple example is a powerful demonstration of views. We can see this too, how powerful views are and how much we cling to our views. The political conversation that's happening these days really kind of highlights this, what we tend to call, what's called in psychology, confirmation bias. And the Buddha talked about this 2,600 years ago with the phrase, whatever one thinks and ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. And this is confirmation bias, that when we believe something, when we have a belief or a view about something, the way we tend to explore and take in the world, the way we take in experience, is through that filter, through that lens, through that perspective. And we tend to have the perspective to look for things that confirm our views and not look for things that disconfirm our views. And so in the conversation in politics, we tend to kind of look for information that supports and confirms our political view and not take in information that doesn't confirm our political views. I even heard another story recently about some research on changing or finding ways to have a civil political dialogue. And what they found is that when you bring two people together who have differing political views, if you ask them to have a conversation in which they try to convince the other person of their own political view, the views get further apart. It actually further entrenches their own opinion to try to convince the other person. We do not take in the information from the other person. On the other hand, if they were asked to repeat back and try to explain when somebody else expressed their view, to try to describe what that person said, then the views began to get a little bit closer. And so this is another way that we might explore kind of looking at our views, looking at how we might explore this question of views when we think that we're right. Maybe it's useful to have a conversation. Maybe we could have a conversation with somebody who doesn't agree with us, and we don't have to say that we agree with them, but maybe we could try articulating back what we think we heard them say. That might begin to bring us into a place where we can have some dialogue. Any time that we are suffering, and so this is a pointer to how views kind of shape the world, create strife, quarrel, conflict in the world. There's one quote in the Sutta Nipata that I love, the translation I love is something like, those attached to perception and views roam the world offending people. And this, again, it points to the attachment to views. We're going to have views. But can we take in or explore it from the perspective of maybe I don't know the whole picture? Kind of like maybe this view is a piece of the puzzle, not the entire puzzle. That pointing that I offered about the elephant. If they had been shown the elephant in a different way, maybe there could have been a civil conversation. Maybe we can bring this into our own minds. Maybe I don't know the entire piece. I don't have to say what I believe is wrong, but it's useful to notice it's a belief, it's a view, that it may not be absolute truth. This same process around views, this is one of the powerful teachings around views, the same process around views also affects how we suffer internally. So it not only connects to how wars and strife in the world come to be, how quarrels and dissent happen in the world, but also how our inner struggles, our inner strife, our inner kind of conflict happens. The same mechanism that creates conflict internally creates conflict externally. And so anytime we are suffering, anytime it feels like there's an inner conflict, there's some kind of you that's operating. The Buddha pointed to greed, aversion, and delusion as being kind of the roots of our suffering. And greed and aversion themselves are based in a view. There's a kind of a misunderstanding, a misperception about what greed and aversion are going to do for us. We could say we have a proclivity towards greed and aversion because of an underlying view that in order to be happy, I need to get things that I want. In order to be happy, I need to get rid of things that I don't want. These are views that underlie greed and aversion. This perspective is operating even if we don't see it consciously. So when there's some kind of suffering, it can be useful to check in. And we can recognize that we are suffering. Perhaps we're frustrated or angry or confused. Sometimes it can be a useful exploration. What's being believed right now? What is being believed? We know that we're frustrated. We know that we're confused. We know that we're angry. What's being believed right now? Sometimes it can be just really simple, like, well, that person is wrong. Okay, well, that's a belief. Maybe we can recognize that that is a belief, because often our beliefs are functioning in this very hidden way. Views and beliefs are often simply taken to be truth and are not even seen as a part of our system. They're just taken to be the underlying way the world is. And so if we can begin to recognize that beliefs are operating, then there can be an awareness. There can be an awareness of the views. And when we can become aware of a view, we can know it is a view. That itself would have helped the blind people and the elephant not to come to blows, not to come to conflict over the elephant. It's like, oh, well, this is a view. I wonder if there are other views out there. What other perspectives? These views and beliefs can be pretty subtle at times. They can go kind of deep. We might see a kind of one level of a view or belief, And then, but what if that's true? What if that belief is true? Like, for example, if you see somebody make a face when you're talking to them, what view, what happens there? You might have the perspective or belief that, oh, that person doesn't like me, or that person thinks what I'm saying is wrong, or something like that. So some kind of belief arises there. So that person doesn't like me. Now, we don't know that that's what that facial expression means. Maybe they just had a little bit of a stomach ache and it created a funny expression on their face. And so we might hold it lightly, our view about what this person thinks of us. But then it can be useful also to go a little deeper. It's like, well, what if it, indeed this person doesn't like me? Is there suffering around that? Do we suffer if we think somebody doesn't like us? And why? What's the belief there? Why does everybody have to like us? What might an underlying belief there be? If this person doesn't like me, then I'm not likable. Then I'm not doing something right. Then I'm not safe. What are the views that are happening? And again, to expose them is a huge part of our practice. When we can see what's happening, this is a big part of the medicine that the Buddha offered, this exploration of mindfulness, of being aware of what's happening. As we can become aware of what's happening inside of our hearts and minds, there's a little space for us, especially around views, to perhaps, just like a little crack in the door that lets us perhaps recognize that it's a belief rather than truth. That if somebody doesn't like me, I'm doing something wrong. You know, at some level, kind of deep, this can be a very kind of deep pattern that, you know, it may not be that we consciously believe that, but that's the way it feels. And so we can expose the belief and that it is affecting us, and yet we may not be able to stop believing it. So the work here, the practice in our meditative mindfulness practice is to begin to explore what are those beliefs and how do they affect me. We often can't simply stop believing something that's very deeply believed, that's very deeply conditioned. Many of our views and our beliefs come in when we're very young, before we even have language. Most of those views and beliefs are not given to us through words. They're given to us through how we've interacted in the world and how our parents were with us, how we were in school and how our teachers treated us. A lot of our views come in in a nonverbal way, and often they aren't really clearly articulated. And when they are articulated, the articulation of the view is not itself the view. And so sometimes we have to just acknowledge, yes, there is a view there, and explore what does it mean to feel that to feel into that view. Be curious about that view. For myself, a view around self-hatred, this perspective, I'm no good, I'm a failure. This was a very deeply ingrained perspective. And the part of the practice was simply being willing to look at it, to watch it, to feel it, to feel not only the view, to know not only the view, but to feel the effect that view has on the system. And over time, I mean, we can at times kind of put out a kind of counter view as a kind of a way to navigate some of these views. Like, well, okay, maybe this view is not wholly true. Maybe there's something else there. And perhaps we can reflect. Like for myself, I could reflect and see, I'm not always a failure. In this particular case, I didn't succeed in the way I wanted to. But is it a true failure? Okay, probably not a true failure. And in fact, just yesterday I did something that worked. And so using reflection can sometimes help to mitigate some of the effect of those views. And yet for myself, what I saw is like that kind of work has to be done carefully, because those views are often so deep. They're so deeply conditioned that trying to tell yourself you don't believe it is not usually helpful. So when I suggest something like using a counter view to balance a view, I encourage people not to try to tell yourself, I don't believe this view. I don't, because those views are so deep. If you try to say you're wrong, that view, that's wrong, it's often so deep that it either gets buried and comes out in different ways, or it just gets stronger. Kind of like the argument of the two people with their views. You know, if you are trying to convince the other person you're wrong, the views get more entrenched. And likewise internally, if you're trying to convince yourself that view is wrong, that view can get more entrenched. And so there's something else that may need to happen there. And the exploration around of, you know, oh, okay, so what is going on there? We could look at the exploration of mindfulness of the view and the effect that it has on us as being kind of like asking the other person to describe your perspective. You know, just let yourself take in what it's like to feel that view. There may be some pieces in there that are, you know, that point to something beautiful. There may be a lot in there that's confused and misguided, but maybe a piece in there that's pointing to, oh, the fear of vulnerability, or the vulnerability itself. And when I think about that self-hatred, I think a lot of it came from the sense of wanting to be loved and feeling like I wasn't loved. And so the wish, the inner wish for love, is a beautiful wish. The perception that I was not loved, sometimes it was that true, sometimes not. And so an exploration, curiosity around views. What is being believed? What is being believed? So, views are very powerful in terms of how they shape our lives. They shape suffering. They shape conflict. And they can shape peace. They can shape freedom. What we believe, what we hold as views can either support us to move towards freedom, or can keep us hooked in a cycle of suffering. And so the Buddha did talk about a particular view that's useful. If what you are interested in doing is understanding suffering, understanding how it works, if you're interested in becoming free from suffering, becoming free from these forces that shape suffering, then there are some particular perspectives that are useful for us. So this is pragmatic. We can think of these views as pragmatic. One way to describe those views is that, and the Buddha actually at one point, when asked to describe his teaching in brief, he said, "Nothing should be clung to as I or me or mine." This includes views. Views should not be clung to as my view or in a way that holds them as being truth. The clinging to views is where the conflict arises from. And so even clinging to a spiritual view, clinging to a view around what will take us to freedom, even clinging to that can create conflict. We see this in religious wars. People clinging to particular views of their own religion. And so the Buddha pointed to not clinging to any view as being, as that clinging to any view at all can lead to conflict. And this included his own teaching. He had this famous simile of the raft, where he talked about the path that he taught being like a raft, the Eightfold Path being like a raft, in which we use this raft to cross over the flood of greed, aversion, and confusion. That this raft is what allows us to stay afloat in the messiness of our lives, our world that has so much greed, aversion, and delusion in it. And the raft helps us to navigate greed, aversion, and delusion, to learn about them, to understand how they are creating suffering in our minds. And the simile, the analogy of the raft, ends with the person reaching the far shore on that raft. And the Buddha says, and so what do you think? The person having reached the other shore, having transcended greed, aversion, and delusion by use of that raft, is it useful for that person to think, oh, this raft has been useful to me, so I better pick it up and carry it around on my head? The Buddha said, no, this isn't useful. It doesn't serve you in that way. But it's more useful to let that raft go, to leave it on the shore or let it go adrift, because you have reached the other shore. And so again, pointing to, he said we should not even cling to the Dharma, not even cling to wholesome states. How much more so we should not cling to unwholesome states. And so the views that he offers are pragmatic to help us to understand greed, aversion, and delusion, but not to be clung to. They're to be used. In one text, one of the texts I love is a teaching by a householder at the time, by Anandapindika, who was one of the Buddha's lay disciples, a great donor to the Buddha. And at one point he was having conversations with other renunciants of other religious sects of the time. And they were all having conversations about what their views were. And they had widely different views, directly contradictory views, in fact. Each one, when expressing their view, would say something like, well, the universe is infinite, this is what I believe, everything else is wrong. Another one would say, well, the universe is finite, this is what I believe, everything else is wrong. And like this, they just had all these different views, many of which were directly contradictory. And they had this belief, this is the only useful view, everything else is wrong. Only this is true, everything else is wrong. So the real pointing to the clinging to views. And after hearing all of this, they asked this householder, Anandapindika, what are your views? Before he told them what Anandapindika's views were, he said, you know, your views are created by
what you've been told by other people, or they're created by your own experience. But in any case, they're created, they're constructed. Your views are constructed. And because they're constructed, they tend to lead to stress. So they're not reality. They're not the truth. It is a construction. And so he pointed to them that they were clinging to something that was that part of, you know, only this is true, anything else is wrong, that they're clinging to something that's constructed, that's impermanent, that's unreliable as a source of happiness for their lives. And so he pointed out to them that these views were not useful in terms of letting go of suffering. And so then they asked him what his view is, and he says, whatever has been brought into being, whatever comes into being, whether it's sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, thoughts, ideas, so including views, whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, willed, dependently originated. It is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stress. Whatever is stress is not me, is not what I am, is not myself. This is the sort of view I have. So basically, he has a view about views. He has a view that views are unreliable, that views are inconstant, that views, when clung to, create stress. And the other renunciants tried to use his same argument on him, saying, well, you're clinging to that argument. And he says, when I notice that something is arising, when clinging is arising, when suffering is arising, when a view is arising, I notice it as dependently arisen. I notice it as inconstant, unreliable. I notice it as not mine, not me, not who I am. And in that lies the release. In that lies the freedom. And so this is a view that is used, that is held to help us recognize, basically, that views are unreliable. So this is a view that's a kind of a, what could we call it? It's a pragmatic view that can help us to transcend clinging to views. And it is the clinging where the suffering really is. The holding that this is what is true. And so wise view is this kind of view. The start of the Eightfold Path begins with wise view. And it's this kind of view, a pragmatic kind of view, that helps us to recognize that whatever is arising, including views, including beliefs, including emotions, it is all transient, impermanent, unreliable, not worthy of clinging to as being a place where I can find lasting happiness. And so we use that view. At first, when we start on the path, we have to, you know, as the view of the stupid mice and the intelligent mice shaped the behavior of the psychology students, holding a view pragmatically can help to shape our engagement with the world. It's useful to know it's not that it is a view. It's useful to recognize that it is a view. And yet what we do with that is we run the experiment. We explore, okay, is this view useful in terms of what it says it's purported to do, which is to help us come to the end of suffering? Is this view useful? Very quickly, we start to see the usefulness of the view in our direct experience. We start to see that when we explore our greed, our frustration, our confusion, begin to recognize it with mindfulness. Begin to look at knowing the views that underlie it. That there's a way that process begins to reshape our minds and begins to allow the suffering, the ways in which our mind has constructed suffering, begins to allow the mind to let go of it. And we feel it directly. We know what it feels like when suffering releases. It's not abstract. It's very direct. And so this perspective or this view, the power of this view, of the right view, of wise view that the Buddha offers that starts the Eightfold Path, is that it can shape our choices in the world that lead us to directly experience, directly know for ourselves this kind of freedom. Well, now it's time to stop. Thank you for your attention.